The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 82, Senator Latz. Senator Latz, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Glad to be here.
Members, we are working off of a delete everything amendment that has already amended the bill. I believe that there were a couple of outstanding issues. I felt that we had a very good discussion last Thursday, and we laid it over to come back today in the hope that perhaps those issues will have had an opportunity to be resolved. I think the way that I would like to proceed is to, the bill is back on the table. If, Senator Latz, if you have any preliminary remarks, we have taken all the testimony on the bill, so it's purely for discussion purposes before we move the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, thank you. I have had a number of discussions with members of the committee with regard to some of the particular concerns that were raised and tried to answer questions and clarify. And I've also had further conversations with the Attorney General's office with regard to some of the provisions in the bill and given some additional thought to what was presented at the last hearing. In response to those, I'd like to ask the committee to adopt a couple of additional amendments that Ms. Pontius has prepared for us. Let's just deal with that first, I guess. One concern that the Attorney General's office had raised with me was the prospect of, it appeared that the language provided for the state, its employees, and political subdivisions to be potential defendants in such a claim. And that was not my original intent, and they expressed a number of concerns about that. And so one of the amendments that we have to offer would clarify that that the state or its political subdivisions or employees thereof.
So that's the amendment that's being passed out right now, Ms. Pontius? Is that the amendment?
That's
the A24, I believe. That's the A24 amendment that's being passed out right now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, is it drawn to the delete everything?
I believe so, right, Ms. Pontius?
That's correct.
That's correct. Senator Latz, could you explain the amendment again? I think it's self-explanatory.
Yes, Madam Chair, A24 would provide that an action under this proposed law could not be maintained against the legislature, the judiciary, and executive department of the state or a political subdivision or their members or employees. So basically no government agency can be a defendant in this kind of a matter.
Any discussions on the A24 amendment? Senator Olson moves the A24 amendment. Is there anybody here who would like to testify for or against the A24 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, also in response to my conversations with the Attorney General's office, I'd like to ask to have the A18 amendment offered.
Let's pass that out first. Senator Latz on the A18 amendment.
Madam Chair, members, the original draft of the bill provides that the Attorney General's office, once notified that a False Claims Act claim has been filed under seal with the court. The Attorney General has the ability, the option to investigate, and if they desire, to intervene and take control of the case. They also have the option to choose not to investigate and or to not intervene and let the relator or the whistleblower and his or her counsel carry the laboring oar and proceed forward with the case without the Attorney General's office formal involvement. If, however, later on the Attorney General's office did decide to intervene, the current language in the bill would not give them the ability to regain control over the litigation. They could intervene, but they'd have to remain basically a bystander or a participant, but not the final decision maker on that. While they do have other options, other remedies for getting involved and, in fact, settling the case out from under the relator if they chose to do so, they were concerned that if they did choose to get back into the case and intervene later in the process, that they have the ability to control the litigation as well. The A18 gives them that ability, but it does protect the relator who has carried the burden, however far the litigation got at the point of the Attorney General's later intervention, so that the court would, the relator would then still be able to recover their share of the proceeds, and in an amount to be determined as fair based on their rate of participation by the court would make that decision. So currently, if there's no Attorney General intervention, the relator can get between 25% and 30%. If the AG does intervene at the beginning, the relator gets between 15% and 25%. And this amendment simply expands the full range from the 15% at the bottom to the 30% at the top, and the court can determine how much would be appropriate at that point.
So, Senator Latz, if the Attorney General's office chooses to intervene at a later date, this preserves the potential recovery for the whistleblower.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
But it also preserves the opportunity for the Attorney General to come back or to intervene at a later date.
And thereby to take control over the litigation if they choose to do so.
Members, any discussions on the A18 amendment? Anybody in the audience would like to testify for or against the A18 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shai.
Madam Chair, if I just might, Senator Latz, you said that you had spoken to the Attorney General's office about this, and this is a result. Both of these amendments are results of that conversation, or?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Shai, that's correct. They expressed a preference for these provisions.
And, Madam Chair?
Senator Shai.
Madam Chair, and did you have any further conversation? I mean, if you do these things, they support the bill, or is are they set up to do this? Maybe this isn't the time we could do the amendment. I just wanted to clarify what the Attorney General's position was here.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, at this point they are choosing to remain on the sidelines with regard to the bill itself. They're not taking a formal position on it, but they did prefer to see these changes made.
Any further discussions on the A18 amendment? Senator Olson moves the A18 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. I have an A21, A22, and A23 amendment. Are all of those amendments that you would like to be offered to the bill, Senator Latz?
Yes, they are, Madam Chair.
All right, so let's take the A21 amendment. Senator Latz, the A21 amendment. Members, you should have all of this in front of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is offered in response to concerns raised by a number of the testifiers at the last hearing and in their conversations with me directly as well. If you turn to page 2 of the Delete Everything Amendment, you'll see on lines 2.16 to 2.18 that clause 7 that was a subject of some concern. I would call this clause the anti-cover-up provision, because what it does is it says that if there was an inadvertence or a mistake, an unintentional erroneous billing that was submitted by a corporation to the government or a mistaken underpayment of a government bill, for example, if that is thereafter discovered by the corporation, the corporation then has to disclose that. If they don't do so, then they become liable. But it was not the intent to hold them liable or responsible under the False Claims Act for the mere inadvertence or mistaken error. So to clarify that, we wanted simply to make sure that that language was specified. In a sense, it's comfort language, but it would leave no doubt as to the intent of the provision in paragraph 7, and that's what A21 does.
For the entities who are concerned about that provision in particular, do you want to come and testify in the A21 to see if it is responsive to your concerns? Members of the committee, discussions on the A21 amendment. Why don't we
move it along?
They're trying to figure out what it is.
Yeah. Chair?
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, if this was not in the bill, question came up regarding a mistake or inadvertence, wouldn't a judge make that decision? Or is this giving guidance to a judge of whether or not to recognize liability?
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, I think that the language already written in paragraph 7 states that the only liability for inadvertence or a mistake would be if the company discovered it and didn't disclose it within a reasonable period of time. But there was obviously some concern expressed at the last hearing about whether that was in fact the case. Ultimately, yeah, if there are questions about language and liability, that would be determined by a judge or a finder of fact if it were a question of fact. Or appellate judges. But the additional language in A21 would make it crystal clear that mere inadvertence or mistake would not itself give rise to the false or fraudulent liability.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Senator Latz, you described your answer using the term that whether a company, does that mean a corporation? In this, and wouldn't that be more of a reference to a product liability claim rather than false claim? I suppose a corporation could make a false claim, but could you define for me the difference?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, on the first page of the Delete Everything Amendment, you'll see there are definitions of person in Subdivision 5. All entities could potentially, if they have some kind of an interaction with the government in which they are either paid by the government to provide a service or product, or if they are if they're purchasing a service or product from government and they are supposed to be paying for it, they could be involved in some exchange of money to the disadvantage of the government, either acquiring taxpayer dollars through falsely submitting a claim or underpaying a bill from the government. And that's the only kind of action which is being circumscribed by the proposed False Claims Act. The more detailed list of that is on page 2, paragraphs 1 through 8, of which paragraph 7 is one of those eight kinds of actions which would fall under the provisions of this and create liability on the part of a person. It could be a natural person. It could be a corporation. It could be a partnership or any other legal entity that submitted a false claim to the state or underpaid a bill from the state.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, looking at your A21 amendment and the language there, I guess to me, I'm reading this differently. I don't think this is how it's intended, but to me, because it says except for conduct described in paragraph A, clause 7, a person is not liable, so forth, for, you know, mere inadvertence or mistake. When I look at it, so to me that says that if it is conduct described in paragraph A, clause 7, then a person is liable for mere inadvertence or mistake, which I don't think is what you're intending, and it's kind of contradictory. So my suggestion would be, rather than making this a separate subparagraph, that you just add the line at the end of that, of paragraph A, clause 7, just a continuation to say a person is not liable for mere inadvertence or mistake, to make it clear that those are two separate things. Because otherwise, the way I'm reading this, it just sounds like there might be some cases where you are liable for inadvertence or mistake, and I don't think that's what you're intending.
Madam Chair,
Senator Latz.
Senator Olson, I'll leave it to counsel to provide the best language for this, but the language described in paragraph 7 does make one liable for inadvertence or mistake if they discover it and fail to disclose it within a reasonable period of time. So that's the difference between what's in the proposed amendments language and what's in paragraph 7.
Well, members, just know that the A21 amendment has not been moved. It's just been offered for purpose of discussion. So if members have concerns about it, you know, somebody would have to move that for us to put that into the bill. Unless I hear somebody moving that amendment, I will set it aside for discussion.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, if I moved it, would somebody come up and speak as to whether or not they feel this, you know? I guess I would do that, hoping that somebody would respond. I tend to agree with Senator Latz that I read 7 if you make an inadvertent mistake, but you do report, you know, self-report or whatever, you wouldn't be liable. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't say this is in the negative because this is saying which acts you have liability for. But
so Senator Scheid moves the A21 amendment. Now, does anybody want to come up and testify on the A21 amendment?
Why do we need this, Madam Chair?
Senator Foley?
I'm curious to know why we continue to trash over this, and it seems to me we were making a much greater issue out of this whole bill that I would have moved 10 minutes ago that we're ready to go, and I don't see any need to delay it.
Mr. Griffin, please state your name for the record.
Members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm speaking today on behalf of my clients, Preferred One and UCARE, as well as members of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And we agree with the intent that Senator Latz has with this provision in terms of trying to take out those inadvertent mistakes. And we would support that type of amendment. We'll leave it as the senator did to council to make sure that we've got it correct. But we certainly support that. And I know there's another amendment on retroactivity that we also would like to take up. So while we agree with Senator Foley, we ought to be moving as quickly as we can to get rid of false claims. We want to make sure that we get the false claims and not the inadvertent false claims and the ones that are retroactive and others we don't think should be covered in the bill, as we testified to earlier. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience would like to testify either for or against this amendment? Any further discussions from the members on the A21 amendment? Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, no, I moved it, right? No, I'm sorry, I do things with my hands. Look, I'm drawing attention to myself, and I don't mean to. I apologize.
Seeing no further discussions, all those in favor of the A21 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. There's the A22 amendment. Senator Latz, why don't you explain that amendment? We'll see if a member of the committee would offer that.
Madam Chair, members, the A22 amendment was simply a drafting clarification. When Ms. Pontius and I were reviewing the language in the bill relating to the statute of limitations, we were both a little bit confused by the drafting. And so Ms. Pontius and I thought maybe she should take a crack at making it more parallel to the actual language in the federal law. So that is That is what you have before you in the 22 amendment.
Ms. Pontius, can you give us a little bit further clarification on this language here? Let's
see, Madam Chair and members, it basically just tracks the language that's in the federal statute.
I see.
As far as the statute of limitations. So it breaks it down into clauses instead of having just one long sentence.
So this is federal language?
Yes.
Senator Olson moves the A22 amendment. Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against this amendment?
Chair.
Senator Lemire.
Madam Chair, this is a statute of limitations provision. And usually we don't have, call maybe a bifurcated way of establishing a statute of limitations. It's usually a single definition. Here you have on lines 5, action can be commenced 6 years after the violation is committed. And then there's the or, and then you've got another window of time that you could do it, 3 years after the facts, material of cause are known or reasonably should have been known by the Attorney General. But what about the individual, perhaps a private citizen, that are they dependent on the wisdom and vision of the Attorney General, or could they make a cause of action on their own after a six-year period of time had been established, if they knew, became aware of facts material to the
Senator
cause.
Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, a private action brought by the whistleblower can only be brought within 6 years after the violation is committed. The second paragraph, as is written in the federal law, gives a little more flexibility to the Attorney General's office when they're bringing an action on behalf of the state.
Madam Chair, why,
Senator Lemmer,
why would we limit the citizen from bringing an action? Let's say 6.5 years goes by, and for whatever reason, they've become aware that there was some type of violation or a reason to cause or a material fact becomes known that wasn't known before, then they cannot bring an action?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Latz.
Senator Limmer, at that point, they would have to go to the Attorney General's office and convince the Attorney General's office to bring the action. It's the same situation under the federal law. And one thing that is particular is that the federal government will review the State False Claims Act to make sure it complies with their essential elements in order to determine whether the state will qualify for the 10% bonus on Medicaid settlements. And in the guidance from the federal government, the statute of limitations is one particular piece that is specified. So we can't be more restrictive. I suppose we can be less restrictive than the federal government in that regard. But this just tracks the federal law on it.
Senator Lemmer.
Chair, thank you. We get a lot of bills through the legislature that attempt to direct the player or the actor as the Attorney General to be the sole person that can bring an action, perhaps against a corporation. And I've always tried to convince the legislature, and sometimes I'm gaining on this perspective that it's all right to trust the individual citizen once in a while to do their own cause of action. Would it do damage to your bill if we also allowed a citizen to bring action under the stipulations of lines 6 through 8?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, one of the main points of this bill is to give a citizen a right under state law to bring a whistleblower action in the first place on behalf of the taxpayers, and as an incentive to do that gives them a share of any amount that's recovered. I don't suppose it does any damage to the purpose of the bill to expand the right of the citizen to bring that action, and I suspect it would not be a problem with the federal government as well, since they were concerned about making sure that the rights of action are as broad as possible. They didn't want any more restrictive than the federal government, but I don't think they'd have a problem with it being more available to a citizen.
All right.
Senator Limmer?
I'd like to instruct council to fashion an amendment that would include a right of action by a private citizen in the same 6, 7, and 8, and fashion amendment that would do that.
Senator Olson withdraws her motion to offer the 822 amendment. We'll lay it aside. Senator Limmer, maybe you could work with council to do that, and we'll bring the amendment back, and then so that we can move on with the bill. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to comment, as long as we're redrafting along the same lines, I don't think this says that the Attorney General is the only one who's limited to bringing an action after 6 years. It simply says it relates to the Attorney General's knowledge about these material facts. So say, for example, if a private citizen happened to know that the Attorney General knew something within this period, it doesn't say who would have the right one way or the other to bring the action. And I don't, again, I think we should clarify that. And if we're cleaning up the language anyway, it probably would be, however we're going to go with this, if we're going to allow a citizen longer time, I think we could make that clearer.
Senator Latz, would it be helpful to have your expert at the table so that he can just speak directly to us? Or?
I certainly could ask him to do that. Gerald Robinson is here. He's a private practitioner in this field and has extensive knowledge of this area.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Gerald Robinson.
So, Mr. Robinson, do you want to comment on Senator Olson's remark on the lack of clarity in that federal language?
My experience, I haven't researched that issue specifically, but the general understanding that we practiced under was that the 6-year statute of limitation under the Federal False Claims Act applied to the relator, and then the second piece there, the 3 and the 10-year, had specific application to the government. I understand the arguments and the issues that are being raised, and I can offer to take a look at it and join in the discussion after the hearing.
Well, so we will table the 822 amendment for the time being, and Senator Limmer, you could perhaps speak with counsel at some point. Let's take up the 823 amendment, and then we may have to... let's take up the 823 amendment. Senator Latz, is that one of the amendments that you're proposing for discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Why don't you explain that to us, and we'll see if a member of the committee would like to offer that.
Madam Chair, the 823 amendment is basically also a clarifying language with regard to the retroactivity provision. It does not change the retroactivity provision that's already in the bill, but it does, Ms. Pontius and I believe that it more clearly reflects the intent.
I see. Senator Latz, so the reference, the cross-reference in the 823 amendment cross-references to the proposed changes that you were making in the 823 amendment, in the 822 amendment. Ms. Pontius, is that a yes?
Madam Chair, yeah, that's correct, yes. Although the amendments stand alone. Okay. But it is referring to that language.
All right. So this is the retroactivity amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, is this is leaving the retroactivity in place.
Just rewording it.
So just we're got rewording. Pardon me.
Senator Scheid, I believe that it is narrowing it and fixing it to the statute of limitations language.
So could we have some response from, well, we haven't moved the amendment, have we?
The amendment has not been moved.
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Olson moves the 823 amendment. Anybody here who would like to testify for or against the 823 amendment? Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Phil Griffin again with Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Madam Chair, as we said before, the general rule is that in the adoption of laws, substantive changes or new laws like false claims should always be enacted prospectively. This is why we are continuing to oppose the retroactive provision of this law. We think the amendment is almost there. If Senator Latz wanted to move pages 6, delete lines 16 and 17, and put a period after that in the amendment, it would solve the problem that we have. We don't think that it is good public policy to be setting up retroactive liability.
But, Mr. Griffin, the retroactivity here merely tracks with the statute of limitations language. So even though in the federal language retroactivity may be silent, it is still an operation. I mean, you do, by operation, have a retroactivity back to the statute of limitations. That's explicit in the language. How is this that different from what current federal law is?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, this provision would allow a 10-year look back in retroactivity, and that is not something that we are in favor of.
Chair.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, why is there a retroactivity feature in this bill at all? Aside from just because the feds do it, what's the reason why we would have a retroactive feature in the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Senator Lummer, the feds don't have a retroactivity provision because their law has been in effect in various forms since 1863. The bill proposes a retroactive provision so that it would allow conduct which is already illegal and for which there is already liability and which is already required, if found out, to have the money repaid to the taxpayers, in this case the government, who spent it on behalf of the taxpayers, to allow this additional cause of action and remedy for that same conduct, and to allow this additional incentive to disclose that conduct, to bring it forth. With regard to Medicaid claims, this would not make any difference because there is already the Federal False Claims Act that creates a substantial incentive for a whistleblower to come forward and say, this is actually happening. I know you, the government, haven't found out about it yet, but I'm going to tell you. And you're going to get $1 million or $5 million or $300 million in taxpayer dollars back because I let you know this was going on. But with regard to non-Medicaid cases, whether it's construction contracts or any variety of other activity services, those kinds of things, that aren't covered by the federal act, that would be brought forth only because there would be a state law claim that could be brought forward. What I'm not intending to do is to give a free pass, number one, to that past conduct, which by contract and other state law is still illegal conduct. But the new part about this law is it would create the financial incentive to bring it forward. So if you start only with conduct which occurs on the day that this act becomes effective, then basically you're saying if a company got away with defrauding the government, stealing taxpayer dollars for the last 6 years, 6 year and one day later, it's too late to bring a claim for that, and basically you can only bring a claim for that one day's worth of false billing. And so it seemed to me if we really want to recapture those taxpayer dollars for that 6 year look back, the 6 year statute of limitations period, which is remaining unchanged in this, then creating this new cause of action to get at that same activity needs to be retroactive.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, the legislature on occasion, and I would say rare occasion, will recognize a retroactivity in a bill. I'm a little fearful that this may create a rather large, unreasonably large potential for fishing expeditions for other claims. And I'm a little hesitant to continue to support the bill with a retroactivity that goes back this deep. Like I said, we do it on occasion, but very rare. And this seems to be beyond the rare standard due to the scope of what could occur. And I'm wondering if you could give me any type of comfort that it would not lead to a large fishing expedition that would be considered unreasonable.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I can't tell you there won't be claims brought that under this law, if it were to become law, that that were fishing expeditions, as you call them. But I can tell you that this retroactivity provision does not create any lengthier look-back period. It doesn't expand the statute of limitations that's currently in effect. All it does is allow a claim for the conduct, which is covered by the current statute of limitations, to be brought under this new cause of action with the new remedy and the new financial incentive to bring it forward. I think, in effect, what would happen is if you have only state law or state actionable claims and this were not to have a retroactive provision, there'd be no financial incentive for a whistleblower to come forward. And in effect, that fraudulent conduct would go unresolved and the taxpayer dollars would be unrecouped for the period going back to the full statute of limitations.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The concern I have with retroactivity is, I want to distinguish what you're saying, Senator Latz. There, in the event of the violation of law in the past, there's still an action for embezzlement and for restitution, so it won't go unanswered. What we won't do is be authorizing the retroactive digging, fishing expedition, bounty hunting, if you will, for activities of Minnesota corporations or residents. It's that bounty hunting that I'm concerned about, retroactive, when they have had to face the potential for embezzlement. It wouldn't affect federal claims, as you've said, so we're just talking now about a very small group, and any violation would still be subject to criminal penalties and the civil penalty of restitution. So I'm still concerned to Senator Limmer that we are creating laws backwards and applying standards that people were not made aware of and didn't have sufficient notice of. And so I can't support the retroactivity in this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Senator Ortman, what you're saying is that if the government knew about this conduct, it could go after someone for embezzlement or fraud. The problem that this whole act is attempting to remedy is that the government doesn't know about most of this conduct. To the extent it exists out there, no one knows about it. It's just like the Petters case. No one knew what was going on until Petters' close associate came forward to tell the world, in particular the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI. If we don't have this financial incentive to bring forth the whistleblower, it will go unaddressed because the regulators don't know about it. That's the whole point. The other piece of the retroactivity provision with regard to Medicaid fraud claims is while the action is still available under the Federal False Claims Act, the state will not have will not be at the table with regard to the existing Medicaid fraud cases that are 190 of them around the country. We will not be eligible for the bonus that comes with passing a False Claims Act, and we could not become a party to those actions.
Ms. Senator Ortman, on this
Madam
point.
Chair, if I could just clarify, we don't know about those claims or those violations yet. It doesn't mean that we won't uncover those violations, that the government won't find that and won't prosecute. And so I don't think that you should assume that we won't find any of those violations from the last 6 years. We still might. And if I'm correct, the statute of limitations for embezzlement is longer than that. And maybe one of you can inform the committee how long the statute of limitations is for embezzlement in Minnesota. Or maybe council could.
Ms. Pontius, do we know what the statute of limitations is? Or
defer to Kim.
Oh, Mr. Backus. Mr. Backus is going to check.
Thank you.
And we'll come back. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Senator Latz. I'm sorry. Senator Latz.
Just one further thought. There was, within the last several months, there was some articles in the paper about the fact that the Minnesota Department of Revenue has not been auditing enough taxpayer forms, and as a result, there was a lot of, shall we say, erroneously underpaid taxes in Minnesota. Shortly after that became public, my understanding is the governor added about 14 new positions in the Department of Revenue to go back and do more auditing. The point of it was that if you do more auditing and investigation, you can find more of this stuff. we don't have enough investigators or staff in the state government or the Attorney General's office to review every bill that's submitted to the Department of Human Services or in the Medicaid to make sure that the underlying cost relating to the bill was valid and accurate. But the people who do know about this are the people who are working in the entity that is submitting these bills. That's the whole point of this.
Senator Orman.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Letts, I'm not arguing that this is a bad idea. I think it's a good idea. It's the retroactivity that I don't like.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and Senator Letts and Senator Ortman, specifically to that point, I guess I would just have to say this is one of those situations where it's either a good idea, from my perspective at least, it's either a good idea or it isn't. This isn't conduct that we're making retroactively illegal. And that's generally where we have a problem with retroactive bills, because then people wouldn't have noticed that there was something they shouldn't be doing and a chance to conform their conduct. This is simply a way to get at and to incentivize being able to find this illegal activity. And if it's ever okay to have fishing expeditions to go looking for this illegal conduct, whether we do it now in the future or do it 6 years backwards, it's the same principle in my mind. So I don't think that anyone's going to not have noticed that they shouldn't have been doing this. And if we can try to recoup some of that money, that doesn't, I don't think that's why it wouldn't be illegal to do this, and that's why it doesn't offend my principles of justice to do this either.
Senator Olson has offered or moved the 823 amendment. Any further discussions on the 823 amendment from members? See none. Any further testimony? We're settled.
Chair, if I might,
Mr. Griffin,
don't want to prolong the hearing at all. But the provision that we're speaking to here is a provision that is not a part of the federal law. And as Senator Letts has said, we are trying to adopt something that will allow us to gain the money that's in the federal law. This is not one of those pieces that's needed. We've worked with the senator, and we appreciate deeply a number of the amendments that he's taken, including some of those he's working on today. But if you want to adopt the federal law, we've given you the amendments that you need to do that, that will get you the federal money that's the incentive. This is not part of that. We'd urge you to oppose that and adopt a provision that does not include retroactivity. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Betzel.
Well, maybe I could get a clarification. If, as Senator Olson indicated, I mean, if it was fraudulent before, it's fraudulent now, and if this bill did not pass, there's still remedies to go after fraud. We have a procedure in this bill that would encourage people to help get at the fraud. Now, if the retroactive activity part was just removed from the bill, if there was, say, something going on right now, but the statute of limitations is running as we speak, would somebody, after this bill becomes effective, be able to use the provisions within this law, even though the clock's already been running? Say it, you know, some fraud occurred a year ago, and this bill becomes effective August 1st of this year. Would they be able to use the provisions in this bill for the fraud that occurred a year ago, or are they barred or limited only to actions that occur after the effective date of this bill?
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, they would be barred from using this bill except for actions which occurred after the effective date of this bill.
But Senator Letts, if the action is ongoing, let's say it commenced a year ago and it's still ongoing, that they would then be able to use this bill, yes?
Madam Chair, my understanding of the effect of a statute of limitations is you'd be able to. This bill would only apply to conduct which occurred on or after the effective date of the bill. If I'm wrong, Ms. Pontius can explain differently. I'm not sure a continuing violation allows you to bring in the new.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Letts, it does, as drafted and also with the amendment, it applies to activity that occurred before the effective date.
But if the retroactivity provision were deleted?
Were deleted, then I think it would be, there's a presumption against retroactivity.
Ms. Pontius, even if it's an ongoing violation that commenced before the effective date and is ongoing after the effective date?
Madam Chair, I think that they could at least get them for the conduct that the part of the violation that occurred on or after the effective date in terms of the damages, you know, the extra damages and everything.
For the damages. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Council, wouldn't that the current statute of limitations for the current conduct be the limitation? Meaning, if I were the whistleblower and I brought a claim for something that maybe occurred last month, but it could still be prosecuted going forward, then I would be providing the information that would bring about this claim, and I would have a claim for the whistleblower recovery because the statute of limitations is going forward after the enactment of the law.
Mr. Robinson, maybe you could help us clarify, and in part it's my confusion too, is that if we... I mean, under the federal law, where there's no retroactivity date.
Right.
Well, because it's so old. Okay. So because the law is so old. All right. So in this instance, let's say that we made it so the Minnesota law didn't have a retroactivity date, but that we put in the statute of limitations language. If we didn't have a retroactivity date, then... is the statute of limitations language kind of meaningless? Is that what
no,
we're
the statute Mr. Limitations, Madam Chair, the statute of limitations language wouldn't be meaningless. As time progresses forward,
I see.
It becomes more and more meaningful. 10 years from now, it will be very meaningful.
I see.
But addressing Senator Ortman's example, if there's no retroactivity in the statute, and something happened last month and it was an isolated event, wasn't ongoing, then once this bill is passed, a whistleblower couldn't come forward and say, I know this happened. The court would say, too bad, it happened before this statute. You can't sue under this statute for that conduct. If the conduct was ongoing, then the suit could be brought for any part of the conduct that occurred on or after the effective date of the statute. And the defendant cannot say, oh, hold on a second, the conduct really started back here before the statute. You can't sue me under it because it's all before the statute. That defense doesn't work either.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, and sorry, I didn't catch your name, but...
Mr. Robinson.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson, can you identify where that language is that you're referring to in this bill?
The retroactivity?
The portion that says that activity that occurs prior to the enactment date could not be part of a whistleblower claim brought within the ordinary statute of limitations.
It's not...
Mr. Robinson?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Ortman. It's not specifically on the face of the bill. It's a matter of statutory construction and case law in this state for over 100 years. So it's well-settled precedent. That's how statutes get applied, and there's a presumption. If there's no retroactivity language, there's a presumption that it's prospective right. only.
Senator Olson?
Chair, Senator Ortman, the A23 amendment, if you look at the language of that amendment, I think specifically says exactly what you said you could support. It, I think, unless I was misunderstanding you, because what it says is that you can bring an action for activity occurring within that statute of limitations period. So as long as the activity occurred going backwards within the statute of limitations period, I thought I was hearing you say that you thought that that would be all right, and that's basically what this statute says it does. Or this amendment, I'm sorry.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think you misunderstood my comments.
Members, I think we've had a good discussion on the 823 amendment. I'd like to take action on the 823 amendment. Sure. And then Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, regardless of what we do on 823, it's my intent to bring an amendment before the committee regarding the whole issue of retroactivity and to simply delete it from the bill. Now, the order of amendment process, does that confuse the issue, or can it be considered separately after this point?
Well, Senator Lemmer, maybe counsel could help us. Maybe you could do your amendment as an amendment to the 823 amendment. as opposed to a separate amendment. Council?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, and what can Council tell me what effect would be if there is no statement of statute of limitations? It seems to me that there are several places in that area that create an automatic liability, even though it's not stated in the law itself, so that there are some statute of limitations that run like 2 years and or 6 years or 8 years. If the author of this took that out, would that in fact be the result of that?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, first of all, I think this amendment actually does not affect the statute of limitations. This is the retroactivity language right now. If the bill didn't have a statute of limitations in it, I think there's a six-year presumed statute of limitations for whenever you have a violation of a statute that doesn't otherwise specify what it should be. There are special statute of limitations for, like, fraud, theft, different intentional torts, so it depends on what the underlying common law cause of action might be. But this amendment actually doesn't deal with it just deals with the retroactivity. And then on the question, as Senator Limmer's question on just the priority of amendments, this amendment deletes or amends the lines that your amendment would just delete from the bill. So you could do this first, but then your amendment would actually delete those lines. So this amendment would kind of go away. So you can do it procedurally either way.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair. But then the language would still, the retroactivity would still be in the bill.
Madam Chair, with the A,
Ms. Pontius?
The A23 just rewrites the retroactivity language, but it doesn't change the substance of it.
Right. Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we vote on the bill, can I have an answer to the question about the statute of limitations for embezzlement?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me that. Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Roman, you're talking about the crime. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, my understanding is generally we have a 3-year statute of limitations for most crimes. For certain thefts, the way I read it, including thefts, certain false representation thefts, theft by swindle, and including thefts where you're diverting corporate property, which I think you would consider embezzlement. If it's more than $35,000, my interpretation is it's a 5-year theft. It's not quite clearly written. I can try to double-check with the prosecutor, but I believe an embezzlement over $35,000 would be a 5-year statute of limitation, and a 3-year statute of limitation would apply otherwise. But I'll double-check that.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Orman,
we're also assuming then that this whistleblower or False Claims Act would be a 6-year statute of limitations.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, this is a civil statute, though. Mr. Backus was giving the criminal ones. Right. So without anything in it, it would probably be a 6-year, but obviously the bill has a 6-year with the discovery twist to it. So
members, I think procedurally I'd like us to take a vote on the A23 amendment. If the A23 amendment succeeds, this new language replaces the retroactivity language that's currently in the bill. If the A23 amendment fails, then the retroactivity language that's in the bill stays, and then we will consider the A15 amendment, which is Senator Limmer's amendment, to delete the language. So any further discussions on the A23 amendment?
Chair?
Senator Limmer.
I think I could offer it either way. Whatever happens to the A23 is...
Correct.
Regardless of...
Correct. All right. So no more further discussions on the A23 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Another real issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
So now this new language of the A23 amendment is on the bill. Senator Limmer, do you still want to offer the A15 amendment?
Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce the A15 amendment, which is a simple amendment.
Oh, wait, I can't.
Recognizes the retroactivity and removes it from the bill.
Senator Limmer, I believe that's not the right amendment.
It's the A20.
It's the A20 amendment that you want to offer.
Oh. Scratch that.
In essence, the A20 amendment deletes this new language that has just been put on the bill with the A23 amendment.
And, Madam Chair, just for clarification, if we
Senator
adopted
Olson?
This amendment,
There will be no retroactive language.
There would be no retroactivity.
You have the 820 amendment in front of you. I don't think we need any more discussions. All those in favor of the 820 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The chair is in doubt. All those in favor of the 820 amendment, please raise your hands. All those opposed, please raise your hands. The amendment is adopted. The motion prevails. Any other motions, Senator Latz? Any other proposed amendments? Any further discussions on the Senate File 82 from members of the committee? See none. I think Senator Latz wished that Senator Olson would move Senate File 82 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. Senator Rest, I'm glad you were here for the discussion. Please report to your members that it was thorough and thoughtful. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Latz. Thank you, Mr. Robinson, for being here. Thank you to the advocates for working on this. Senator Rest, Senate File 107. Goodness. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, the Senate File 107 deals with duties of the legislative auditor with regard to disclosing the results of an investigation which would show that an employee used money for a purpose other than the purpose for which the money was appropriated. And it was first heard in the State and Local Government Committee. I've been doing some further work on it and would, I think there are a couple of amendments that your staff has been kind enough to write. And also I've had some conversations with the Attorney General as well as the Legislative Auditor who is present to comment about the bill. Essentially, it has moved the making sure that the misuse of public money or using it for a purpose other than which it was intended gets into the criminal statutes. And in the third section, it deals with establishing best practices for investigations. And we have had suggestions for three amendments that the committee has, and would also, I don't know if you want to have them described, and then you can decide whether you want to act on them.
Is this the first committee? Is this the first committee for the bill?
No, it's not.
Okay. So let's I believe you have three proposed changes to the bill.
That's correct.
So let's put them in front of the members, and then we'll have you describe. I believe the A4 is in front of everyone. Do you want to start with the A4?
The A4 amendment came as a suggestion from following a conversation with the Attorney General, and she suggested that in line with the rest of the paragraph, which says that the heads of agencies would consult her in order to develop the best practices, that the same thing should be true for the Commissioner of Finance. And so the effect of the A4 amendment is to direct the Commissioner of Finance to develop those best practices, and certainly he would be able, or she would be available to be consulted with. So the line would be, the thing would be the deleting line 2-8 and inserting the Commissioner of Finance must develop and make available those best practices.
Is that, Senator Rest, was that the A4 amendment? I'm sorry.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone who would like to testify with regard to the A4 amendment? Are there any? Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, just a question. The Commissioner of Finance, is that the current title?
Yes, it is.
Madam Chair, there is going to be a bill coming forward that changes the statutes where Commissioner of Finance is referenced to the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. But when we're dealing with the statutes now, we have to use the old term.
Members, do
as
you
far
have
as
any,
I understand.
Any other questions with regard to this amendment? Senator Foley, would you like to move the A4 amendment?
I will. Yes.
Senator Foley has moved the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes. And Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, there are two other amendments, the A2 and the A3. Do you have both of them?
Yes, thank you, Senator Rest.
The A2 amendment came from a discussion with Senator Mua and Senate Counsel, and it makes a number of revisions, and I'm reading from the memo now. Some are substantive, others are technical. The substantive changes include adding the phrase, unless a greater penalty is specified elsewhere in law. If you're looking at lines 1-8 and 1-9 in Section 2, and the purpose of that would be to the new language would then avoid a potential interpretation that the gross misdemeanor penalty is a cap on criminal liability. Thus, if a person is subject to a more severe criminal penalty elsewhere in the law, that more severe penalty would apply. Then secondly, there was a suggestion coming from Council and Senator Mua that Section 2 become effective on August 1st, 2009, rather than immediately, because the Judiciary Committee has a preference to make sure that effective dates, immediate effective dates for criminal law provisions not be adopted, so to give criminal justice system time to deal with the amendment. And then there's, you know, as I mentioned, some technical things of just cleaning up the language.
Senator also moves the A2 amendment. Any discussions from members on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, is anybody here who would like to testify on or against the A2 amendment? All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I think the other amendment that you have is the A3 amendment, and this comes as a suggestion from the legislative auditor, and I would invite him forward to discuss why we would want to take the word employee out of the statute with regard to financial audits and their duties.
Mr. Nobles, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for
the
record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And I made this suggestion to Senator Rest since I thought this bill was relevant to the issue of the investigative work that we do. And it would simply remove what I consider to be a contradiction within our statute. You see that, and I'll just read the sentence. It says, the legislative auditor shall see that all provisions of law respecting the appropriate and economic use of public funds are complied with, and may, as part of a financial auditor, separately investigate allegations of noncompliance. And then we would remove the language by employees of departments and agencies of state government and the other organizations listed in this subdivision, and then there are specific subdivisions listed above that. The reason I'd like to remove that language is that we oftentimes are asked to investigate noncompliance by people who are other than state employees. For example, there are people on many boards and commissions who use public funds who are not technically state employees. So that would be one reason.
And an example of that, more recent example, although we did not do anything improper, was the Sesquicentennial Commission.
And the other reason, Madam Chair and members, would be, and you did not do anything
inappropriate no, we didn't
that we were aware of.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does occur on occasion that we are asked to investigate board or commission members that have allegedly done things inappropriate. And also we investigate the use of public money by a nonprofit organization. As you know, members, a lot of them receive public funds through grants, and we have on occasion investigated that alleged misuse. I must say we have never been obstructed in our attempts to conduct those investigations, but I simply thought this language could potentially be used as a barrier. And again, I mentioned that I think that removing this language would bring us into consistency with other language in the law, which we have used on occasion when people have suggested that we are going beyond our authority. Minnesota Statutes 3.978, Subdivision 2, reads as follows. All public officials and their deputies and employees and all corporations, firms, and individuals having business involving the receipt, disbursement, or custody of public funds shall at all times afford reasonable facility for examination by the legislative auditor, make returns and reports required by the legislative auditor, attend and answer under oath all the legislative auditor's lawful inquiries, produce all books, accounts, documents. It goes on. The point being that this provision of law makes it, I think, clear that we do have the, at least the requirement on the part of people who are not technically state employees to comply and cooperate. So we simply want to bring this other language into consistency. So that's the reason we brought it to you.
Senator Scheid moves the A3 amendment.
I do.
Anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on the A3 amendment? Any further discussions from members on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Senator Rice.
Anything else for us to consider on the bill, Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Well, you know, Senator Rest, I'm glad that we made that change. I was a little bit worried that the way that money pots get shifted around here, that we might be implicating a lot of officials. Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 107 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Good job.
Senator Russ, Senate File 91.
Madam Chair, Senate File 91 requires the Commissioner, again, the Commissioner of Finance, and these are set up a searchable database, which actually they are working on already. You may remember a number of, 2 years ago, I guess, we directed the Department of Administration to do one, to develop grants management and to have a database that was accessible to the public. And this takes that a step further in the first section, and I hope you have the engrossment there because we added some language relevant to the legislative auditor and having the audit audits that were done of these of any of these state agencies available either by a link or the kind of information that we would want to have there. But the substance of it is that the Commissioner of Finance, in consultation with Revenue and Administration, would maintain a website with a searchable database with information on state contracts, state appropriations, state expenditures, and state tax expenditures, and then make some provisions for each data field. It's my understanding that the interest in the Judiciary Committee in a an email and communication that I received from Ms. Pontius has to do with maintaining the classification of the data and making sure that non-public data was excluded from the database. And so to that end, you have the A3 amendment.
Members, the A3 amendment is in the packets, and Ms. Pontius has a small an oral amendment to it, and then Ms. Pontius will explain the A3 amendment.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, it should be on page 1 after line 12 now, because I was drafting it to the original bill. Okay. And it just makes it clear that the website is not going to include any data that are not public data, which I think was the intent, but it was never explicitly stated. So,
and I believe that this is the reason why the bill is in the committee, members. So Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment. Senator Betzel?
Mr. Chair, it's the first gross. Is it line 12 or line? Where does the language go, though? After the period, I see. Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Anybody here in the audience testify would like to testify on the A3 amendment? Any further discussions from the members? All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any further discussions on Senate File 91 as amended? Senator Olson moves that Senate File 91 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? You know what? Is anybody here in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Thank you for waiting. I hope we didn't make you late.
No problem.
Senator Higgins, do you have people here to testify on your bill?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Higgins, and then I think this one, I hate to say this, but this will be a fast one. Is Senator Gimsey here? Oh, very good. Senator Gimsey is on deck. Senator Higgins, Senate File 230. Members, as you look at the bill, it's a thick bill, but let me reference it for you. There are only two small sections that are in this committee's jurisdiction that which brought it here, and those are sections 26 and 27. Only. Let me look here. And Senator Higgins, your testifier will speak only to that section, yes? Those two sections. And then the audience members, we will take testimony only on those two sections in the committee. So, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senate File 230 is a technical corrections bill that updates Chapter 147A, the statute regulating physician assistants, who are often called PAs. This bill makes no change to how the PAs are educated, how they are regulated, their relationship with their supervising physicians, what services they provide, their requirement for continuing medical education, or any other facet of their practice. The bill is before the committee today because of two provisions. Both include a cross-reference to 256B, the section of Minnesota law dealing with civil commitments. Currently, 256B.05 sub 2. Didn't I sound like a lawyer on that?
253B.
Allows a PA to sign the 72-hour hold emergency admissions request. The language at line 13.31 and 32 merely repeats this and places it in the PA statute. This is necessary because there are several instances in the past where the PA's signature was not accepted because of confusion over how 256B.05 governs the PA scope of practice. And that confusion resulted in delaying some needed medical care. The change at page 28, lines 27 and 28, further clarifies the situation by including PAs in the definition of examiner in 253B.02 subdivision 7 for the purpose of the emergency 72-hour hold. Again, it doesn't expand any current authority. It just clarifies the current authority. Joining me today is Bev Kimball, a PA, who is representing the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants.
Members, do you all have questions on these provisions of the bill? Because I think Ms. Kimball could answer questions if there are specific questions, but I just think that it's kind of straight up. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I just wondered, on page 28, I haven't read the whole bill. I just kind of tried to pay attention to what we're talking about here. We are adding licensure, though, right, for physician's assistants. That's my first question. And secondly, is an advanced practice RN certified in mental health, is that the same training as a licensed PA? I mean, I know they're kind of equal on this line, 28.28, so.
Yeah. Well, Ms. Kimball, why don't we have you answer that question and incorporate any other comments that you were going to offer in your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Scheid. Education for PAs and NPs is not identical. PAs are trained in a medical model, whereas NPs are trained in a nursing model. Not being an NP, I can't really speak to NP education. But you are correct that in this instance, it's pointing out that advanced practice RNs and PAs in these certain circumstances would be authorized to sign for that 72-hour emergency admission. Now, one point to be made is that PAs have no authority on our own. Any authority that we have is a delegated authority through our supervising physician. So if the supervising physician didn't feel that it was appropriate for me working in convenience care in a doc-in-a-box to sign a 72-hour hold, then I don't have that authority. If I'm working in an emergency room where I do need that authority and he or she feels that it's appropriate, then it's delegated. But if it's not been delegated, we have no authority. In addition, you are correct that part of what this bill does is it changes the terminology from registered to licensed. It doesn't change, as Senator Higgins pointed out, it doesn't change our education. It doesn't change anything else. It's merely a terminology change. And we could, you know, talk about why that's important if you wanted us to.
Ms. Kimball, can you just state your name and the organization you represent for the record?
Certainly. I apologize, Madam Chair. My name is Beverly Kimball. I'm a physician assistant. I speak on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants.
Thank you. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I'm fine.
Okay. Senator Betzel?
And just to be clear, it's my understanding that this is already in law, except that some people who are familiar with the commitment statute, which is 253B, didn't realize that it was in law because they only looked at 253B. They didn't look elsewhere, and so they said it didn't count because it was in another chapter. It wasn't in here, so now we're just putting it in here so that when they look in 253B, as in the other chapter, it's in both places now. That's where we're at.
Is that correct?
Actually,
Ms. Kimball.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, it's actually the other way around.
Other way, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It was placed in 253B.
But wasn't the other place.
But it was not placed in 147A, which is our statute, and so there was confusion.
So they it didn't count because it was only the commitment statute, not in the other place, and so now they want to have in both places.
Right, it's so that there's no longer any question.
Gotcha.
Okay. Any further discussions? Anybody here in the audience who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate File 230 to be recommended to pass.
And be referred to the floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Higgins. Senator Gimsey. Number
members, in your packet you have the summary and the bill. And then Senator Gimsey has also sent us some documents that are part of the packet. So you should have the complete packet. Senator Gimsey, Senate File 143, welcome to the committee. Is this the first time you're in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee?
This is the first time, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here to discuss Senate File 143, and thank you, committee members, also. Senate File 143 is a bill that clarifies state statute and closes some minor loopholes that have been identified as far as documents that our law enforcement is sometimes seeing being used to as forged documents, and the whole host of problems that those forged documents cause within the state of Minnesota and for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. I gave you a number of items in the packet, to illustrate the significance of the problem. I think in our everyday life we probably don't recognize just how big this problem is, but six of us senators went around the state here about a year ago and talked to law enforcement. We talked to business owners, both large and small. And we talked to Health and Human Services folks around the West Central Minnesota area, where we have a significant issue with the proliferation of forged and false documents being used to gain employment. Like you'll see in your packet, there's probably about 20 articles from the local paper out there, the West Central Tribune, in which aggravated forgery, which is the use of false and forged documents, were used to gain employment. The same documents are being used to receive public assistance illegally. And those are all public safety issues. They're also taxpayer issues in so much as people are misappropriating the funds, the hardworking tax dollars of the people of the state of Minnesota. And so this bill closes some loopholes. And in a little bit here, we'll have Candiota County Attorney Boyd Beckew testify, and he can really lay it out there well for you. But I think what I would like to do, Madam Chair, is start with BCA agent Eric Knutson, if I could, please.
Mr. Knutson, welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Eric Knutson. I'm a special agent charged with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Go ahead with your testimony.
I would just like to comment briefly on the statewide perspective as it relates to this law change. We have seen this proliferation of fraudulent documents throughout the state on a variety of different investigations that our agency and local agencies have been involved in for several years now. One of the most high-profile investigations that members of the committee here and Madam Chair you may be aware of was the murder investigation of Callie Jo Larson in 1999 in Waseca, Minnesota. It involved a gentleman who was had a number of aliases, I think up to 10 or 12 different names that was being utilized, had committed a number of crimes. Trying to track this gentleman and trying to locate him became very difficult, into trying to pin him down into the variety of criminal activity that he was involved in the South Central Minnesota area. We also see a large number of investigations where our agents are involved in narcotics crimes, where we see this, again, a lot of fraudulent documents being manufactured, executing search warrants in the state where we're actually seeing these documents being manufactured in the homes of residents in the state of Minnesota here. So this has become a severe public safety issue for our investigators as well as local law enforcement.
Any questions for Mr. Knutson? Mr. Knutson, when you say the proliferation, these are specifically federal documents. So the proliferation of fabrication of documents, are those strictly federal documents that are being fabricated, or are you seeing other types of fraudulent documents being made?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're also seeing driver's licenses, Minnesota IDs, some of the other documents that pertain to state law enforcement we're seeing as well.
And Mr. Knutson, on a day-to-day basis, how often, let's say on average of all the cases that you work on, what would be the roughly the number of cases where it involves federal documents and then that involves state documents?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a very difficult question to quantify. Mm-hmm. I do think we see an extensive amount of both in investigations that we're involved in. I think County Attorney Becky here can give you some more specifics on what he sees on a local level. On a statewide level, we see a variety of each.
And Mr. Knutson, at the state level, when you do see the federal documents involved, are you restricted in some way from pursuing those cases because your state agents and those are federal documents are involved?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are not restricted. It just makes it a little bit more difficult. We typically try to include federal law enforcement at that time to get some verification of the documents to see if they are legitimate and to provide some other expertise in that area.
So, Mr. Knutson, if this were to become law, we would still need federal assistance in order to authenticate or look at the federal documents, yes?
Madam Chair, that would still be very helpful, yes.
Okay. And, Mr. Knutson, under current practice, if we don't have these, are we specifically prohibited if federal documents are involved? Are we as state agents, you as state agents, prohibited from involving the case? You have to bring in the feds, or can you pursue it independent of the feds?
Madam Chair, I think it depends on the circumstance of the case. Typically, if we can find a state statute that pertains to that fraudulent use of that, we're able to prosecute that. I think Mr. Becky will be able to address that a little more succinctly than I will be able to.
Very good.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I have some questions, but I just maybe we should wait and hear from the...
That would be good.
Okay.
All right. Ms. Becky, thank you for coming to committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Boyd Beckew. I'm the Kandiyohi County Attorney, a position I've held since 1991. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the County Attorneys Association, a past president, current co-chair of the Criminal Law Committee of that organization. My marks today, however, are my own and do not represent a position taken by the association. When I was first asked to consider this bill a year ago, I must admit that my initial impression was that there was not much which could be added to the aggravated forgery statute to make it more effective for law enforcement and prosecution. However, when I read the proposed amendment, I realized that it is narrowly drawn and well designed to close unfortunate loopholes in the current law. At this time, the aggravated forgery statute, Minnesota Statute 609.625 Subdivision 1, has seven subsections describing classes of documents which, if forged with requisite intent, constitute aggravated forgery. While those seven sections appear to be all-encompassing, a review of the amendment reveals that the existing law has significant omissions. The proposed amendment adds an eighth category of documents, those described on lists A, B, and C of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Employment Eligibility Form, the I-9. While most of the documents on those three lists, A, B, and C, clearly fall within the existing seven categories specified in the Ag Forgery Statute, there are several which do not. Five of them are found on I-9 List B, documents which establish identity. They include a school ID card with a photograph.
Mr. Beck, you hang on a second. Members, the list of documents is on the document that looks like this. This is the I-9 form, and it's in the, I believe, on the third page. Please continue. I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure that'll be helpful to the members. I'm looking specifically at List B. They include such things as an ID card with a photograph, a Native American tribal document, a school record or report card, a clinic doctor or hospital record, and a daycare or nursery school record. One of these, the Native American tribal document, is also found on List C of the I-9 documents that establish employment eligibility. While An attorney could construct an argument that any of these documents can be construed to fall within the existing seven categories of the Ag Forgery Statute. It is just as easy to make an argument that they do not. Thus, in view of the rule that criminal statutes must be strictly construed and only applied where the conduct is clearly prescribed, the following situation is clearly presented. Forged school documents or tribal documents, for example, could be used to support employment verification on an I-9. Documents of this nature are often more easily altered than more traditional records used to support an I-9, such as a birth certificate or a Social Security card. This would defeat the purposes of the Department of Homeland Security requiring an eligibility verification, as well as that of the Minnesota statutes, ensuring that only genuine documents are used to establish legal rights, privileges, or obligations. In view of the narrow and specific nature of the amendment and the importance of our aggravated forgery statute, I support Senate File 143 and hope you will as well. Some may say that Minnesota prosecutors should not be concerned with the use of forged documents to meet the requirements of the I-9, that it is a federal matter. I do not agree. The use of forged documents to support an I-9 in this state is also a violation of Minnesota law, not just federal law. Moreover, given the volume of such cases, it is highly unlikely that the U.S. attorney would be able to handle all of them. I also believe that it is the responsibility of every American law enforcement officer to do what he or she can to enforce the law of the land. Cooperation among all levels of law enforcement is a hallmark of good government. Over the past 3 years, we have seen a steady and alarming increase in the number of cases in which aggravated forgery is committed to obtain employment or other rights. In 2006, my office prosecuted 37 cases of aggravated forgery, 29 of which involved false identity by an undocumented alien. In 2007, 55 aggravated forgery cases were prosecuted in my office, of which 53 were undocumented individuals. Last year, we charged 63 cases, 58 of which were cases involving undocumented persons. The majority of these cases involved I-9 forms. These are not victimless crimes. It has become increasingly common for my office or local law enforcement to receive inquiries from persons victimized by these crimes. I'm speaking of those whose identity was used, almost always citizens with Spanish heritage surnames, often from Puerto Rico or the southwestern U.S., but sometimes from Minnesota. The difficulties they face range from problems with the IRS for failure to pay taxes on the income they allegedly made at a job here in Minnesota, to demands that they account for this additional income in the context of child support proceedings in their home states. It has become an increasing burden for local jurisdictions to assist these people with clearing their records. One can only imagine the difficulties the victims themselves face in the meantime. A victim may have his driving privileges suspended for non-payment of support. He may be subject to revenue recapture or even be summoned to court to account for income supposedly earned in a state that he had never visited. The debate over whether the jobs obtained with falsified documents would otherwise have gone to U.S. citizens or whether the need for workers in certain industries is such that crimes like this should be overlooked is not a debate I seek to join today. I leave the debate over immigration policy to others. My perspective is that of the prosecutor. My concern is law enforcement and the protection of our fellow citizens who are too often the victims of these crimes. Thank you for listening to my comments, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'd just like to comment that Kandy, Ohio County is actually the county where I was born. I was born in Wilmer. My grandmother, I can remember this as clear as a bell, being on the streets of a little town called Sunburg, which you probably know if you're from that area, about 45 years ago. No one on the street was speaking English. Everyone spoke Norwegian. And I just say that as a reminder that that was a community built on the workforce of immigrants. And I like to tell that story because I think it's very appropriate for our state. Not that we ever want to condone criminal behavior or illegal behavior, but just to remind ourselves how important immigrants are, and particularly in Candiokai County. But now to get to the legal aspect of your proposal, Senator Gimsey, which I notice you don't have any of the organizations of lawyers, whether prosecutors, courts, you know, anyone who's endorsing or supporting this bill. And I wonder if it might be because, unless I am misreading this, your testimony has all been about this, the
I-9
form. But as I'm reading this, your proposal would make it an aggravated felony for anyone to alter a driver's license, for example, whether it's in relation to this I-9 form or not. And regardless of what you may have prosecuted in your county, just my common sense of having grown up and been a college student would tell me that we really don't want to make it an aggravated felony for every college student that might alter a driver's license to try to get into a bar. And that's exactly what you're proposing here. I mean, you're proposing that someone who alters identification to commit a theft, for example, would have a higher penalty than the theft itself. And so from the standpoint of just common sense, this doesn't make any common sense to me. I can't even imagine what the fiscal note would be if we were to prosecute every college student who altered a driver's license and put them in prison for 10 years, much less whether that would make any sense. So those are my comments.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Beckew.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, very familiar with Sundberg. I've been in Candiokai County for 30 years, and when I used to go to farm auctions up there, I still heard many people speaking Norwegian. This is not about immigrants. It's about crime. As far as the driver's license is concerned, it is already illegal in the state of Minnesota and can be charged as aggravated forgery if one alters a driver's license and uses it for the purposes outlined in Section 609.625. The proposed amendment doesn't change the law with regard to driver's licenses. It is already, and we already rely on the discretion of prosecutors across the state not to charge college kids with aggravated forgery when they change a driver's license to try to buy a beer. We charge them with underage consumption of alcohol. But the proposed amendment in Senate File 143 does not make any change with regard to those driver's licenses.
Senator Betzel?
All right.
Well, Mr. Jubecki, you testified that you've prosecuted a number of cases relating to forgery under the law as it currently is. And it's certainly been my experience that whenever there's a perceived shortcoming in the law, if the statutes just don't, you know, aren't there for the prosecutors, boy, the county attorneys don't hesitate to come running the legislature to change it. Even if they lose one little case somewhere, they're always running in here. I just don't understand, and educate me. I mean, if you've been able to do all the prosecutions under the current law, why is this necessary? What haven't you been able to prosecute? And you said even as recently as years ago, you said you didn't know if it was necessary. Why do you now say, well, geez, if I would have had this, I could have, you know, prosecuted these other cases? What out there have you seen that makes this change necessary?
Ms. Beckew?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, the charging of a crime of aggravated forgery can go two different ways. You can charge the forgery itself, which is the altering of document, or offering a document in support and then signing the name of another person. But there's subdivision 3, which is uttering a forged document. And prosecution generally likes to charge crimes in all ways that are appropriate under the statute. This gives the jury options. Jurors like to be presented with options when they're considering a case. Right now, if someone apply for a job and use, let's say, a tribal document and a school record to support identity and job eligibility, I could charge the offense of forgery under Subdivision 1. However, I could not charge uttering because those two documents are not currently included within the aggravated forgery statute. I know it gets complicated, but it's a matter of the ability to charge and deal with these crimes appropriately.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Attorney, I'm concerned about what you said back a little bit in regard to the you know better than to charge somebody in regard to a college student in an altered driver's license. And in the first place, I don't see any real need for this legislation. And secondly, I think this is a serious attempt to abridge or deny the human rights of individuals that if you're looking at the folks that were in the communities of Worthington and this place in northern Iowa that the individuals, the ICE came in and did all of their big raid and so, but they didn't do anything to Hormel or some of the other business stations. So if this is so bad that you need new legislation to deal with it and more officers to enforce it and more attorneys to enforce it, then you better start looking at who these are and what you're going to do with them. Under the existing program, I tell you, I'm not voting for this legislation. I think this is terribly discrimination, and I therefore you make your own comments.
Senator Olson, do you want to follow up on this?
Yeah, Senator Moore, and just to go back to the point that we've been having here, and Council showed me a statute. I mean, the statute we have in place, so I would dispute with you that this is just closing a loophole. To me, this is extremely broadening the law to make it an aggravated felony, something that was never contemplated. We have a statute in place right now that talks about altering driver's licenses, and it's a misdemeanor, not an aggravated felony. And so I don't think we can pass a law and say, we'll just leave it to you, Mr. Prosecutor, with all due respect, to say that this could be interpreted very broadly, but we'll make sure that you use your judgment to only prosecute those people that we really, wink, wink, want you to go after. I mean, that's just not how we pass laws in this state. If it's going to be a broad law, then it's got to be appropriate as to anyone you would apply it toward. And the law as it's written today makes it an aggravated felony to forge some really some very specific documents that talk about having an official seal or the seal of a corporation, a public record. I mean, these are fairly uncommon compared to, like, say, a driver's license, I would argue. We have a specific statute that says it's only a misdemeanor to alter a driver's license, and now you want to make it an aggravated felony to alter a driver's license when we know that this is not an uncommon thing at all, and it happens for all kinds of reasons. So I guess I would just say that I think that's probably why we don't have any, you know, attorney organizations here or anyone else supporting this, because, as I said before, I can't imagine we could argue that that would be appropriate.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, if you'd brought in 150 lawyers to testify on this bill, it probably wouldn't change my mind, and it certainly wouldn't convince me of what is my own sense of common sense. So I don't care whether you've got 150 organizations or not. I think we should look at this bill regardless. It is our responsibility. The bill is before us, and I think we should give it a fair consideration regardless of who's here to testify in support or to speculate about who might not be here and why they're not here. I just don't think that that's giving this bill a fair hearing to begin with. But secondly, I can see where subsection 1 was intended to be the catch-all for this crime of aggregated forgery. And I can see where there are some problems with subsection 1, that it's not as clear as we might think it should be, not as clear as I think it should be. So I think there are some justifications for considering Senator Gimsey's bill. And I guess maybe one other point I'd like to make, and I'll go back to the list, but before going any further, this is there is a high threshold for this crime. It is an intent to defraud. It's not just reckless. It is an intent to defraud someone or some entity. And so I think that you need to look at that, that what is required for intent. But if I could continue, I just wanted to make a point that the I-9 is the basis for every employment decision made by every private employer and public employer in the state of Minnesota. You have to establish credentials based on this form in order to hire somebody legally. And so every employer in the state of Minnesota relies upon the documents that might be provided by an employee based on lists A, B, or C. And they have to provide either a document from list A or a document from list B and C, if I understand it and recall my practice. So that makes that these documents that much more important in those hiring decisions, and the employers then rely upon those documents, and because they're making those decisions relying upon these documents, they need to have some assurance that they're truthful documents, and then they are not prepared with the intent to defraud them. And so maybe it's a long argument, but I get the point. The point is we have people that rely on these documents. They're critical documents, and the statute probably doesn't refer to school records or report cards, but the I-9 does. And so I see the point here. I don't think I need 150 lawyers to tell me that it makes a good point, that Senator Gimsey has made a good point, as has the county attorney, and I appreciate your bringing it forward.
Senator Gimsey, surely, though, you don't mean to cover a 16-year-old who is applying for a summer job through the county who somehow altered his report card from all the C's to the A's, to A's. I mean, you don't mean to capture that individual in the bill, do you?
Absolutely not, Madam Chair, and I think that that's a misrepresentation of what we are trying to do. As a number of comments that have been made about this bill and the intention of the author and those sitting at this table, my grandparents lived in Sundberg, Minnesota. My grandpa was a mail carrier his entire life, a Norwegian, spoke Norwegian, but he didn't have sophisticated computer equipment that can generate quite easily many of the documents that we're seeing out there today. You know, birth certificates from Honduras and Puerto Rico, you know, something as easily as altering a school record or a school ID card or a photograph. You know, this to me, and I want there to be no mistake about it, is about the law. This is not about discriminating against anybody. There is two sides of the immigration debate. There's a legal side and there's an emotional side. I prefer to take the road of the legal side and try to stop as best we can, which is our responsibility as legislators, the criminal activity associated with some of the activity that's going on out here, and which includes undocumented individuals in this state and in this country. But like Mr. Beckew said, this is not a victimless crime. Behind each Social Security card that's forged and a number that's forged, there's an individual whose reputation could be ruined, his credit rating could be ruined, and tax consequences that we're seeing virtually on a daily basis out in West Central Minnesota, according to law enforcement. We're seeing police officers that are stopping individuals that have 6 and 8 Minnesota driver's licenses. Same picture, different name, different address, and they're using those the Minnesota driver's license for a whole host of
things that we don't want them to be using them for.
Well, Senator Gimsey, I think that the issue is not necessarily with the Minnesota driver's license, since we have a number of state laws on the books that, you know, deals with that. I understand, though, that your proposed language here does create some fuzzy lines and uncertainties in terms of now, you know, which statutory section will apply. But given that, I think the question that I asked earlier was not being facetious. I mean, I do have some concerns about the 16-year-old, because I think when Senator Olson says that the bill seems a little bit overbroad by making a cross-reference to all the I-9 documents, it does incorporate for persons under the age of 18 who are unable to present other documents, the school record, the clinic record, the doctor's record, whatever. And so Mr. Becky, I would come back to you that in this instance, I guess, would you then use your prosecutorial discretion to not charge a particular person? How would you know not to charge somebody, or how would you apply this law if it does pass with respect to all those 16-year-olds who alter their report cards?
Madam Chair, again, this amendment, Senate File 143, does not in any way affect or change the law of the state of Minnesota with regard to driver's licenses. It simply does not. As far as those offenses that are listed under the school records, many of those apply to persons under 18. We do have people living in Candiota County seeking employment who are under age of 18, living independently without their parents present, who are here illegally, who do use these forms. That's the purpose of the I-9 having that category of form for persons under the age of 18. In the appropriate case, yes, we could use this if it was altered. Without the amendment, we could not prosecute aggravated forgery for use of a forged school report or a forged daycare or nursery school record.
Well, Ms. Becchio, though, that's not helpful to me. My question is, you know, when John Johnson alters his report card to apply for a job with Candiota High County this coming summer, he will be captured in this law. He will come under this law. So I guess I'm asking you, are you then going to prosecute John Johnson under this law? Because if that is your intent, then I do think that it is overbroad.
Madam Chair, I doubt that John Johnson or anyone applying with the county is filling out an I-9. In fact, I don't think the county's got any employment to offer this summer. We'll probably be laying people off this summer. The point of the thing is, in the appropriate case, it would be charged, but hypothetically, you know, you can have a million different hypotheticals.
But Mr. Becky, doesn't every person who applies for a job have to fill out an I-9, regardless if they're John Johnson or me moi?
Madam Chair, if the employer is following federal law, yes, they do.
So in my example, if Johnny Johnson goes to apply for a job with a county, he has to fill out an I-9 form, and he presents a forged report card or an altered report card. Doesn't that bring him under the jurisdiction of this proposed law?
If it was used for establishment of his identity, which is the category of the I-9.
Yes. Yes. As specified in the I-9 form.
If he used it for establishment of identity, yes. I can't imagine that circumstance happening.
Well, why couldn't you, Mr. Becky?
Because I don't think he's going to have the need to forge a document to establish identity. He will have other documents that are legitimate to establish identity.
Chair? Senator Olson?
Just one attorney to another. Mr. Becky, I'm just going to have to respectfully disagree with you. I think the way that this is written substantially changes the law regarding driver's licenses, and I would also point out that this has nothing to do with the way that this is drafted. It does not say that the only reference to the I-9 is that it makes it an aggravated felony, an aggravated forgery, to use one of those to alter one of those documents that are identified in the I-9 categories. Doesn't say that it has to be used in the process of filling out an I-9 or that an I-9 necessarily has to have anything to do with the forgery, just that one of those documents identified in an I-9, which are driver's licenses and all these other things, would become an aggravated forgery regardless of what purpose you were using it for. But that's how I'm reading this, and I think that that hugely broadens the category of what would be an aggravated forgery. But then I would also say that with regard to fraud and Senator Ortman's point, it seems to me ironic that we would consider it more troublesome from how we're going to punish to say that you're worried about fraud in applying for a job. So getting a job, somehow trying to get a job, that's more likely to be considered fraudulent than passing a bad check or committing some kind of act of theft, because certainly that's another reason why people would alter identification. And that's a big concern of mine because I'm on the Financial Crimes Task Force Oversight Board, but I still don't think that we want to make the identity changing part of that more significant than the theft part of that. So, again, to me, this is just extremely poorly drafted because it gets at way beyond what you say your purpose is. Senator Gimsey, I don't doubt what you say your motive is, whether I agree with it or don't agree with it. But this is the Judiciary Committee, and we can't pass language based on what someone's motive may have been for passing it. We have to pass language if we agree or don't agree with what it says on its face.
Senator Higgins and then Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I have about three random thoughts here that probably don't have anything to do with each other, but I'll throw them all out anyway. I'm worried about the whole concept of writing a law and then saying, well, prosecutorial discretion would have it enforced some other way. I really do think it's the job of this committee, probably more so than any other committee, to make sure that if we pass a law, it says what we mean it to, and that we expect the people who are going to be enforcing it to enforce what we write. And you all know I'm a word jockey in, my past life, and it's just so important that what we write into the law is what is enforced, and it's clearly stated, and it says what we mean. And this whole prosecutorial discretion thing really kind of struck a sore point with me. The second thing I thought of was when Senator Gimsey was talking about his grandfather and, people of that generation, if they had to forge a document, it just wasn't done. It was done with an eraser because it was typewritten or it was handwritten. Different time, different place, different tools, same issue. But it wasn't not done. It was just different tools. Third thing was when I was in college, my fake ID said I was 5'7" and 107 pounds. I was never one, and I was about fifth grade on the other.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for sharing, Senator Higgins.
TMI.
I care about this bill, Madam Chair, but I've never been to Sunburg, Minnesota, and never heard of it until today, but I do care.
How about a road trip, Senator Ortman?
We're going to have plenty of chance to get through there in one of these next days. But I think Senator Gimsey is trying to accomplish something that is important, but the committee raises some valid concerns that he should be addressing, I think, and could be working through some of these issues. The report card thing is, kind of tough. And so I hope that Senator Gimsey will continue to work on that. And with that said, I'd like to move to table this bill.
It's a non-debatable motion. And Senator Gimsey, I guess you don't get input on that. So on Senator Ortman's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Thank you, Mr. Beckew. And thank you, Mr. Knudsen, for coming in.
Manjitak.
Hittuk. Tusintuk.
Members, we're finished with the work for the day. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned.
5'7" and 107 pounds. That was the best.
You know, I never
Some bouncer nailed
I was so straight.